British regard for proprieties and his Oriental love of bombast, he seemed Chinese. And now he got to the meat of his visit. You might think that I, as a Neolani teacher who had brought Hong Kong to this point of his education, would object to the proposal that you now transfer him to Punahou. Not at all. A family like yours is entitled to have a son at the best school Hawaii can provide. There he will rub elbows with future lawyers, business giants, community leaders. If I were a key, I would suffer any humiliation to get my son into Punahou. Hong Kong, stand up. I tell you, Keys, there is as fine a boy as Hawaii has ever produced. He merits the best. Hong Kong, depart. When the embarrassed boy had gone, Uliasutai Karakoram said, Wu Chao's auntie, it will be very difficult indeed for you to get that boy into Punahou. He's too intelligent, and your family is too able. The white people want to have one or two Chinese in their school, but not the best. They prefer slow, stolid boys of no great imagination. The Lum boy is ideal. Hong Kong is not, because even Buddha himself would refuse to prophesy what Hong Kong may one day accomplish. Africa, are you aware that you have sired a revolutionary genius? Hong Kong has far more power than I ever had, Mr. Blake, Africa confessed to his old teacher. Wu Chao's auntie, Uliasutai Karakoram pleaded suddenly, would you not consider trying to get some other grandson into Punahou? No, Nyok-tsin replied evenly. He is a brilliant boy. He deserves the best. The big Englishman shrugged his shoulders and said, if you're determined to go against my advice, let's see what evil tricks you ought to attempt this time. Who visited Punahou last time? Mrs. Africa Key, a handsome, modern Chinese wife, raised her hand. Stand up, Blake snapped. He studied her carefully, dressed as she was in Western style, and said, couldn't we send someone a little less modern? White people feel safer when an Oriental looks more like a coolie. There were some things the Keys would not tolerate, which was what made them a significant family, and now Africa said simply, if my son applies to Punahou, his mother goes with him. May Buddha bless all stubborn people, Blake said magniloquently, for without them this would be a most miserable world. But could not your wife dress a little more inconspicuously? She must look prosperous enough to pay the tuition, yet not so self-assured that she would ever say anything in a meeting of the children's parents. We want her to look unalterably Chinese, yet aspiring to become a decent American. We want her to look proud enough to clean her fingernails, yet humble enough to remain slightly stooped over, as if she lugged baskets of pineapples about the town. He bowed grandly to Nyok-tsin and said, do you think your son's wife can acquire the proper look of a Chinese appealing to white people for help? No, Nyok-tsin said coldly. I thought not, Blake said sadly. Then you are prepared for Hong Kong to be rejected again? At this point, America, whose two sons had tried in vain to enter Punahou, returned to the meeting and growled, we are prepared to be rejected forever, Mr. Blake. I am sorry that you were not all born a little more stupid, the flamboyant Englishman said, because then, with your money, you'd be accepted gracefully. But of course, if you had been more stupid, that one in particular, and he pointed at Nyok-tsin, why, you wouldn't have the money you now have, and you would be kept out of Punahou on grounds of poverty. Do you think Hong Kong has a chance this time? Nyok-tsin pleaded. No, Blake said. If I were a white man in Honolulu, I would never allow one of you damned Keys anywhere. You're smart. You work. You gang together. You're ambitious. First thing you know, you'll be teaching your daughters to lure white men into marriage. Xiong Mun is going to marry a naval officer, Nyok-tsin said softly. In the hot room, Uliassutai Karakoram Blake stopped ranting. He looked at the fresh, handsome child he had once taught, little Ellen Key, who could sing so charmingly. Gravely, he went up to her, kissed her on the cheeks, and said quietly, "May the compassionate Buddha have mercy upon us all. The years of our lives are so short, and the currents of the world are so strong. Goodbye, dear Keys. You will not get into Punahou. Not this time." When he was gone, the elders of the family considered the many ideas he had proposed, and Nyuk-sin said, "That strange man is right. Hong Kong's mother does look too modern, as if she were forcing her way upon the Haoles. It will be too easy to reject her. This time, we really must send someone else. How about Europe's wife? She's Hawaiian." "No," Africa cried. "He is my son, and he will report to Punahou with his own mother, and if they reject us again, let it be so." "This time, then, I will go along," Nyuk-sin announced. "I will be barefooted, and I will represent the old ways." "No," Africa protested again. "My wife, who will dress as she pleases, will take my son to Punahou and seek admission. I will tolerate no subterfuges." "Africa," the old matriarch said softly, "the school has shown that it will accept one or two Chinese. Now it is terribly important that one of our boys be chosen. Please, this time allow me to arrange things." "I have business on the Big Island," Africa said solemnly. "I shall go there and bear no part of this humiliation." He left the room, and the clan breathed more easily, for he was a stubborn man. Now, when the Lums got their son into Punahou, Nyuk-sin counseled, the boy's mother wore a very plain dress and her hair straight back, and she kept her eyes on the floor. "I am therefore going to say flatly that Hong Kong's mother cannot go this time." "I will go with my husband to the Big Island," Africa's wife announced, and she too left the plotters. After much discussion, and after carefully studying the devices by which earlier Chinese families had managed to get sons into Punahou, the Keys hit upon an involved strategy. Barefoot Nyuk-sin would go in smock and pants to give the proper coolie touch. Europe's wife would go as a pure-blooded Hawaiian to show that the Keys respected local traditions. And Australia's wife, the pretty Ching girl, would go in a very modest Western-style dress to prove that the family knew how to eat with a knife and fork. The boy, Hong Kong, who had an intellectual ability four levels higher than anyone then studying at Punahou, would tag along in a carefully selected suit that bespoke both the ability to pay tuition and a quiet gentility not common among newly rich Chinese families. It was a hot day when the four Keys drove up to Punahou in a rented carriage, it having been decided that this was slightly more propitious than walking. And in the interview, the three women played their roles to perfection. But Hong Kong squinted slightly and thought just a little too long before answering questions, brilliant though his replies were, and in due time the family got the news. "We regret that this year, due to overcrowded conditions, we can find no place for your son, whose marks and general deportment seemed otherwise acceptable." The letter was delivered to Africa in his law offices, and he sat for a long time pondering it. At first, he was consumed with rage at the humiliation his family had willingly undergone, and then he spent about an hour shoving the formal letter about his desk into this position and that. Finally, he summoned his son, and waited until the boy came in, breathless from play along the river. In even, unimpassioned tones, he said, "Hong Kong, you will not go back to school any more." "I thought you said I was to go to Michigan." "No. What you require to learn, son, you can learn right here. Tonight, you will start reading this book on Hawaiian land systems. When you're through, I'll give you your examination. sitting in that chair. Are those your school books? Yes. You'll never need them again. Slowly, Africa Key, who loved education, took the books and tore them apart. Throwing them into the wastebasket, he said, When you study your new book, you are to memorize the end of every chapter. Hong Kong, you're going to get an education that no man in Hawaii has ever had before. Ultimately, of course, the Keys did squeeze a boy into Punahou. It happened in a most peculiar way. In 1910, the Republican Party had difficulty finding the right man to run for the legislature from Chinatown, and somebody made the radical proposal, Why don't we run a Chinaman? Oh no, one of the Hewlett boys protested. I don't want that radical Africa Key in government. I wasn't thinking of him. I was thinking of his brother Australia. A hush fell over the caucus, and smiles began to play upon the faces of the white men who ran the islands, for Australia was a man whom men could like. He wasn't too bright, played a good ukulele, was honest, didn't have too much education, but did have a host of friends among both the Chinese and the Hawaiians with whom he had been reared. Furthermore, he had an appealing nickname, Kangaroo Key, and without even taking a vote, the caucus decided that he was their man. Kangaroo Key was elected by a huge majority and kept on getting elected, and in time he became the leading Chinese in the Republican Party, a man everyone loved and trusted. Fortunately, he had a son who, like himself, was gloriously average. And in 1912, Punahou felt that at last it had found a key who could be safely admitted to the school. On the day this boy enrolled, Nguyễn Xin walked secretly to the entrance of the school and hid behind one of the palms to watch one of her grandsons at last enter the great school. As she saw the bright faces of the Haole children gathering for the beginning of the new term, chatting of vacation experiences, she recognized here a Hale and there a Whipple, and thought, The white people are crazy to allow Chinese in this school. This is the secret of how they rule the islands, and they have a right to protect their interests. Then, coming up the street, she saw her grandson walking with his father, the politician Kangaroo Key, and she withdrew into the shadows, mumbling to herself, This boy knows nothing. He is not worthy of this great school, but he is our beginning. For 13 years, Kamajiro Sakagawa rose every morning at 3:30 to cut wild plum, storing it for his hot bath. He then ran to work, labored till sunset, ran home, and lighted his fire. He now charged 2 cents for the first 10 men to enjoy the clean hot water, a penny each for all who cared to follow. Over the course of a year, he obviously earned quite a few dollars, and like all the Japanese laboring on Hanakai, he watched with excitement as his hidden funds reached toward the mystic number, $400. From the arrival of the first Japanese back in the 1880s, it had been agreed that a man who could return to Hiroshima with $400 in cash could thenceforth live like a samurai. With $400, the workmen assured one another, a man could buy 3 good rice fields, build a large house, get all the kimonos you would ever need, and live in splendor. Every plantation laborer was determined that he would be the man to accumulate the $400, and almost none did. It was appalling how the money slipped through the fingers of a well-intentioned man. In Kamajiro's case, his weaknesses were neither gambling, nor women, nor alcohol. No, his were far more expensive, friendship and patriotism, and they kept depleting his funds. If a workman faced what appeared to be an insoluble crisis, he went at last to Kamajiro and said bluntly, I have got to have 81 cents. Why don't you borrow from the Japanese moneylender in Kapa'a? Kamajiro asked. In Kapa'a, if you borrow 81 cents, next payday you have to pay back the loan and 81 cents more, the workman explained. And he was correct. No white man in Hawaii, ever abused Oriental labor as viciously as the Orientals themselves did. Men close to the Japanese consulate had organized a racket whereby incoming workmen were required to pay a deposit to safeguard their papers for eventual return to Japan. And the substantial sums of money were kept year after year with no interest, and when the time came to leave, the deposit often could not be found, and some Japanese became very rich. At every point, vicious practices gnawed away the financial security of the workmen, and interest rates of 100% a month were common. So usually, rugged little Kamajiro had to cough up the money for his friends. Some of the Japanese men had begun to bring brides in from Japan, and this was always costly, throwing unusual burdens upon the whole community. There were photographs to be taken in Kapaa, fares to be paid, travel to Honolulu to complete the paperwork, and store-bought black suits in which to be married. The amount of connubial bliss underwritten by stalwart Kamajiro was considerable, and this was a self-defeating game, because he found that as soon as a man and woman got together, there were apt to be babies, which caused further financial crises. There was thus a constant drain upon his resources, and at times it seemed as if he were paying for the family happiness of everyone but himself. His biggest expenditures, however, arose from patriotism. If a priest came through Kauai telling of a new war memorial, Kamajiro was the man who contributed most heavily. When consular officials from Honolulu appeared to explain the great events transpiring in the homeland, Kamajiro paid their hotel bills. He contributed to the Japanese school, to the Japanese church, and above all, to the Japanese reciters who passed through the islands periodically. These men were the joy of Kamajiro's life, and whenever one was announced, he worked with greater speed, impatient for the Sunday afternoon, when the entire Japanese community would gather in some park of casuarina trees, sitting on beds of dried needles, to wait for the appearance of the reciter. At 1:30, after the Japanese had enjoyed their lunch of sushi and sashimi, a movable platform of boards, covered by a traditional cloth, was put into position, with a low lectern bearing a closed fan. A hush fell over the crowd, and the visitor from Japan, usually an elderly man with bald head and wide-shouldered starched uniform whose points swept out like butterfly wings, stepped onto the platform in white tabi, bowed many times, and sat on his haunches before the lectern. For some moments he seemed to pray that his voice would be strong, and then, as his audience waited breathless in the sunlight, he picked up the folded fan and began chanting. I shall speak of the Battle of Ichi-no-Tani, he cried in mournful voice, singing each pregnant word and holding on to it. In those first moments, he seemed like an imprisoned volcano about to burst into wild fury. And as the events of that battle, which had taken place more than 700 years before, began to unfold, the man's voice began to acquire new force. He projected himself into each of the characters in turn. He was the brave warrior Kumagai. He was the handsome youth Atsumori. He was the horse, the cliff, the flute. He was the brilliant hero Yoshitsune, and all the women. As his excitement grew, the veins of his head stood out as if they might burst, and his neck muscles could be seen like pencils under the skin. At the various crises of the ancient battle, he roared and whispered, sobbed and screamed with joy. But when it came time for Atsumori to die, this bewitching young warrior playing a flute, the man reported grief as if it were a tangible thing, and the entire audience wept. How terribly real was the heroism of Japan there under the casuarina trees! How fair and loyal the women were, how brave the men! And as the battle drew to its tragic conclusion, with the plantation hands sobbing for the lost dead, the reciter added lines that were not originally part of the epic, but which he had been told were especially appropriate for distant colonies like this one on Kauai. And as the ghost of Atsumori left the plain of Ichi no Tani, the reciter cried mournfully. He looked back upon the gallant warriors who had slain him and thought, "These are the brave soldiers of Japan, and while they live there is no danger to the homeland. They can march for miles through hardship. They can live on nothing to support their emperor. They fear no enemy and withdraw from no storm. They are the bravest men on earth, fighting for just causes and the glory of Japan. How strong they are, how noble, how fine it is to see them on the battlefield. Oh, how I long to be with them again, the brave warriors of Japan." A program consisted of four recitations, and since each lasted more than an hour, with famous ones like Ichi no Tani requiring nearly two, the afternoon usually crept on toward darkness before the recital ended. How one man, taking so many varied parts and throwing his voice up and down the scale as if by magic, could last 5 hours was always a mystery. But in time, a convention grew up at the Hanakai readings which made the last item on the program the best of all. It was initiated when a reciter announced, "Today I have a special reward, the story of Colonel Ito, who threw himself upon the Russian guns at Port Arthur." And someone remembered that their own Sakagawa Kamajiro had once played the role of Colonel Ito in the victory procession in Honolulu, and he was sent to fetch his uniform. So while the reciter told the impassioned story of Colonel Ito and the Russian guns, Kamajiro, 5 feet 1 inch tall and with arms like hoops, stood rigidly at attention beside the platform, wearing the imperial uniform which had been sewed up by the women of Honolulu. At such moments, a strange thing occurred. He became Colonel Ito. He could see the Russian guns and smell their powder. When the emperor spoke as the troops were leaving Tokyo, Kamajiro could hear the august words, and when the colonel died, defending Japan against the barbarians, Kamajiro died too, and entered the pantheon of heroes. Spiritually, he was part of Japan, a warrior who had never yet borne arms, but who stood ready to die for his emperor. It was after such moments of exultation that he contributed most heavily to war funds and military hospitals and all such good works. The constant pull of Japan and its emotional history was so great that Kamajiro did not know one Japanese who intended remaining in Hawaii. All labored 12 hours a day for 73 cents, the pay having been raised in hopes of returning to Hiroshima with $400 and a bright future. And although from the presence of an increasing number of white-haired men and women, it was obvious that the majority never saved enough money to get home, not even the most despairing ever admitted that they had given up hope. One night, at the conclusion of a Japanese movie, the Buddhist priest called for attention, and a spotlight was thrown upon him by the projectionist. "I want Sakagawa Kamajiro to step forth," the priest said, and the stocky little workman moved into the lights, blinking and keeping his left fist to his mouth. "His Imperial Majesty's Consulate in Honolulu has directed me," the priest said, "to award this scroll to Sakagawa Kamajiro in recognition of his contributions on behalf of the brave sailors who lost their lives at the Fukushima catastrophe. All Japan is proud of this man." To Kamajiro,